Hello, welcome to the Anime Podcast. My name is Alex. I'm here with Lindsay.
Hi.
And we're moored in isolation in the Bermuda Triangle. It's quite warm, if filled with ghostly spectres. Some of Jeffrey Epstein, but we'll get back to him later on. This week we'll be talking about the coronavirus, its effects. I mean, what is it? Its effects societally, economically, which, again, you all know what it might mean for the future, which is interesting. And we're going to be having contributions from Oisin, Will, and Dimitri. So hopefully you enjoy our take on all this, the anarchist take. So in our first section, we're going to be talking, Lindsay and I, about the coronavirus. Again, if you've been living under a rock, you'll learn something about what it is. If you haven't been living under a rock, well, this might be somewhat perfunctory. But anyway, we're going to go through it nonetheless. So, Lindsay has a bit of a background, a bit of one in sciences. And so whenever I have a question about medicine, science, or anything that's more complicated than an abacus, I go to her. And so I suppose we'd best start with something very simple. What is the novel coronavirus?
Okay, so... coronaviruses are a class of viruses that can cause illnesses in mammals and in birds. Now, the novel or new coronavirus, nCoV-19, which causes the illness COVID-19, is believed to have started out in bats or birds. And then the current theory is that possibly due to China's wet markets, that's the most likely culprit here, that it jumped species to a pangolin, and then the pangolin was eaten by humans in China, and that is how it spread to mammals in this case. So COVID-19, obviously very serious respiratory illness. Coronaviruses can cause other diseases in humans. Like the symptoms could be like the common cold, or in the case of SARS and MERS, we saw more serious respiratory symptoms, more in line with what we're seeing with COVID-19 now.
So at this point when we're recording, it is the 12th of April. All of us associated with the Anime Podcast are obviously in a kind of lockdown at the moment in our various locations. We're talking now a good, I suppose, month or two since we last released an issue, kind of a issue, for reasons you can probably figure out yourself. How do you think, Lindsay, it got from a position where it was kind of the butt of a joke in the beginning of, certainly in the beginning of February, a rather terrible joke if you were making fun of people in Wuhan, but nonetheless a joke for some people, to where it is now that certainly across most places in the West, countries are on lockdown? How did something that was based in Wuhan, certainly in January, but even in early February, most people weren't paying attention to it, how did it spread throughout the world so quickly?
Well, I think the main cause here is that it started out in China. China had previous experience with viruses and with exponential growth in viruses, and therefore their containment and lockdown procedures were ones that the population were already familiar with. Now, as SARS and MERS didn't really affect us in Europe before, we didn't really know what we were dealing with. Couple that with the fact that, who knows, we can't really trust the figures coming out of China, especially as COVID-19 was usually not recorded as the cause of death. The cause of death would be listed as respiratory failure. So those figures also weren't reliable, but we didn't really know what we were getting ourselves into here in Europe. We kind of, I think, had a false sense of security because we haven't seen anything like this since the Spanish flu, and, you know,
was 100 years ago. Yeah. Just for anyone who doesn't know.
We can talk more about the Spanish flu in a minute with regard to lifting of lockdown procedures.
Sure.
But I think
it's the question I was kind of trying to wonder is this uniquely infectious? How did it spread? Literally, how did it spread from Wuhan to the rest of the world and take root so quickly? Obviously.
Yeah.
So is it uniquely infectious?
Well, it certainly seems to be incredibly infectious. Now, even if it were as infectious as the common cold, you know, common cold doesn't really affect people that negatively, as seriously as we're seeing COVID-19, of course. But the fact that particles in the air may actually survive for a few hours is what we're hearing, along with varying survival rates on different surfaces, like paper, I think is only a day, but then on metal surfaces, you could be looking at, and plastics, you could be looking at the virus surviving for 3 days. That, along with the fact that the public here have never worn masks because we've never been exposed to a situation like this before in Asian countries, they got that under control pretty quickly. Those kind of cultures that are more about the community and people doing what they can for the community, people are wearing masks because even if it doesn't protect them, it protects other people from them if they are contagious.
A lot of the cases are also asymptomatic, aren't they?
Yes, it's believed that in quite a large proportion of people, up to, people can't agree, up to, I want to say, about 60% of cases, maybe even 70%, it could be asymptomatic. Then in others, it could just seem like a mild cough. Younger people can be walking around infected with it and not realise they have it. Then our testing has left a lot to be desired in our country and in many other European countries. So it's a whole number of factors that are kind of coming together in a perfect shitstorm.
And we should probably say that right now the Irish stage is on lockdown till the 5th of May. Originally it was to be the 12th of April. In America, similarly, it seems likely that because the states have control over these things, but it seems likely that the stage as a whole, as in the United States, will be in lockdown again until early May. The moment, today, the death rate in the US is about 20,000 people have died so far, which is not pleasant, but it seems likely that will increase quite a lot before this is finally over. And again, we can talk about that, and some of our contributors will be talking about how America could have prevented that. But anyway, in Ireland as it is, I think the death rate is, do you know what the death rate is? How many people have died, that is?
We're only in around 600 or 700, I think. And I say only because compared to lots of other countries, you know, we're doing pretty well in terms of not overloading our ICU units at the moment, but...
So it should be said right now, Italy, about over 19,000 people have died. Spain, I don't think, is that much further behind. Maybe, I don't want to say a figure if I don't know the exact one, but it's a large figure. The country that seems to be doing the best, that seems to be responding the best, other than South Korea, Hong Kong, which isn't a country, I know, is Germany. And people have said this is because there is an enormous amount of testing, somewhere in the region of 500,000, I think it is, a day now. Testing, they went into lockdown, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago, whenever the exact date is. Do you think that the response to this in a country like Germany, a country like South Korea, is an appropriate response? Do you think that that's how you deal with a pandemic like this, that through lockdown, through huge numbers of testing, is that the way to respond to it?
Well, South Korea has managed really well. Their testing has been just so stringent. You mentioned Germany there. They're doing so well with their testing that we've sent them over 26,000 samples so far to test for us in private laboratories over there. With South Korea, they had experience with SARS and I believe MERS also, so they knew what they were doing. They had a strategic response unit prepared and ready to go. I'm not sure that we really had any plans in place for if something like this happened. So that would be the difference there. Now, I had said our death rate we thought was about 600. I think it might actually be under 300 at the moment. 401 deaths are forecast by the start of May in Ireland. I just had to fact check that. But yeah.
So given that the countries which are seem to be worse affected, because we don't know the exact figures on China, so we're not going to make too much statements about China. But it seems that the countries that are most badly affected are Italy, obviously, because they were the hardest hit early, Spain, increasingly Britain now, America, Netherlands not doing well, and we've even heard bad things today about Sweden. All of them did seem to not have taken it seriously, which, as we were saying, nobody was particularly taking it seriously in early February or even late February for that matter. Mm. Only really late February did people begin to take it seriously. Is there something to be said for how Ireland responded to it, do you think? Because you have particular knowledge of obviously what Ireland's doing and not doing.
Mm.
We, I think in early March, began to take it properly seriously. While people were still making unwise kind of drives to beaches and to hillsides to go on walks, it seemed people were generally speaking taking some degree of distancing seriously. Certainly by, let's see, what was it, 12th of late, well, it would have been late March, wasn't it? What date was it that the Leo Varadkar introduced the lockdown?
God, it was about 3 years ago at this stage.
Well, it was about it would have been around just over 2 weeks ago. He introduced it, and it seems to have worked mostly well. Again, the numbers that are coming in are disputed because we've been sending tests to Germany, and those aren't included.
Yes.
So the actual numbers we won't know until probably a year or two from now when everything is. Someone writes a book about all this, but. Earlier, you were mentioning the Spanish flu, influenza. Yeah. Now, influenza, it was an influenza strain, wasn't it?
Yeah. If we go back there, just to what you were saying, though, about what has Ireland done or not done and how have the public responded, I think it's important to state that from the beginning, certainly very early on, as the coronavirus spread to different countries, it was acknowledged that we would be dealing with the situation here in Ireland, and efforts were made to, first of all, get at least one lab in the country testing for the novel coronavirus, because new virus needs new assays to be performed.
Mm.
How are you going to test for it if you've never seen it before? You need to set that up. And then we tried to expand to testing in various hospital labs as well. So that has been scaled up as quickly as it can. However, it's been a problem because we've never seen anything on this scale in Ireland. And then when we look at how the public have responded, you're always going to have a certain amount of idiots, you know, going against everything that you're trying to achieve. I think at the beginning, Irish people certainly didn't take it very seriously, but I think we've done a lot better than other countries because we've had the benefit of seeing it hit countries close to us very hard. Yeah. But if we want to look at the Spanish flu, as you mentioned there.
Yep.
So Spanish flu was a form of influenza. Now, of course, we could talk about the fact that it wasn't actually Spanish in origin. It was believed to come from originally US soldiers.
Kentucky, I think, or Kansas.
Yeah.
A chicken farm near one of the bases.
And just being that the Spanish noticed it because they weren't as busy.
Well, they were with warring. They were reporting it. Yeah. Unlike the Western, well, not the Western, the Allied powers who were fighting Germany decided not to report it.
Yeah.
Because they thought it would hurt the war effort. So yeah. Only Spain was actually recording the amount of deaths and the amount of people being affected. Now, the Spanish flu, the influenza strain that arrived at the time was unique. Oh, wasn't it? Because it was mostly hit young people between in their late teens to mid-20s. Whereas, and had a very high death rate from what I can see. Whereas the COVID-19, and it's debated at this point what the actual mortality rate is, because it varies, but somewhere between 2-3% is a conservative estimate.
Spanish flu was believed to only have a death rate of between 2-3%.
I suppose it was affecting people of different age, though, and so people, I suppose, were more shocked by it at the time.
More concerning. You had healthy people who should be bouncing back. I believe a lot of kind of delayed response to the current coronavirus pandemic has been due to the fact that at the beginning we were seeing elderly people dying and immunocompromised, but the people in power being younger than that, usually there was a sense of, sure, they've had a good run. Like,
it's not maybe, reason to shut the economy down.
Yeah, and sure, maybe we'll get out of paying a few pensions. Looking at you, UK. But yeah, so the age group that has been most affected, there was a big difference there, of course.
So the Spanish flu, the influenza strain that hit in 1918 through 1920-21, that again it depends because there's no solid figures on it. Somewhere between 20 to 50 million people died, maybe more, certainly not less. This is obviously very early stages, relatively speaking. There could be multiple waves of this. It could evolve, could change. It's perfectly possible it could do that, and we could be looking at a situation of at the very least up to a year to 18 months, and that's assuming everything goes correctly in terms of finding a vaccine and dealing with the suppression. Would you think it's possible in today's day and age that we could see as many as 20 million people to 50 million people dying, like happened with the influenza?
No, I really don't think that's going to happen. Now, another thing to remember with the Spanish flu was that they had less experience than we do in dealing with pandemics, and the lockdown was lifted too soon in that case, and then that led to thousands, or I don't know how many thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands more deaths, and stretch the whole debacle out for a lot longer. What we, I believe, will be looking at in this situation is restrictions are relaxed and then cases surge and there's the ICUs look like they're about to become full. So then we go into full lockdown again. And then once the strain in the hospitals is reduced, we could relax restrictions. Then we'll have to go into full lockdown again. I believe that's what we're looking at. And the number of deaths, if you think about it, it's even intuitive. The number of deaths that result is due to increased pressure on hospitals because of an increased number of infectious cases. And then due to that, you don't have people getting the medical attention they require because the hospitals are too busy.
So the main purpose of lockdowns in countries is to make sure that the health service in respective countries have enough ICU beds and extra beds, right? It's not about stopping it. It's about trying to stop the speed.
It's a controlled spread, I suppose you could call it. So we've probably all been hearing about flattening the curve. And the curve would be, say, the number of cases at any one point in time. And if you think, well, it's over time. So, you know, the number of cases grows and that's the curve going up. And eventually the curve will come back down because at a certain point, everyone's going to have immunity. But as we get there, we come over the other side of the peak and the curve goes downwards. Now, if we flatten that curve, it means we could have like some little spikes, and then we could try and halt as much as possible the number of new cases over a period of time, and then we might have a little trough and then another little peak. And it's just about making sure that the ICU beds and ventilators are available for that percentage of people who are going to be gravely ill and need that kind of intervention.
So assuming that it takes between a year to 18 months, assuming conservatively, to get a vaccine, assuming that the type of kind of basically state in involvement in controlling people's movements, where people go, will have to continue over that period. Do you think that's what we'll have to do? That it will be in and out of lockdown? Again, you don't have, it's just an academic guess. Until there is a vaccine, do you think that's what's going to be happening? Will be in and out?
Yeah, I do. And it's not as though a vaccine will be a magic bullet either. Every time you have a vaccine that's really necessary, that's needed by a group of people, especially a large group of people, you're going to have shortages in vaccines too. So we're just going to have to start with vaccinating the elderly. You're still going to have a certain amount of young people who become gravely ill and maybe even die. But the vaccine itself, in the production, you're going to have global shortages of reagents that are needed for the production of the vaccine. So this is going to be seriously long haul. And then as we continue with weeks and months of lockdowns, there's going to be civil unrest in countries. There's already mumblings of things about to kick off in Italy, perhaps. And we're going to have the army in, depending on how pissed off and antsy people get at being locked in their houses all day, basically.
Can you think of any examples? And don't worry if you don't know any, of when there has ever been something similar to this, where I can think of coups when governments are overthrown and people are told to stay at home, but even those,
that's don't, your forte though.
Yeah, no, I know, but even those don't last this long. I won't be lasting as long as you suggested this.
Yeah.
So there's really nothing to compare to this in modern era. And I think from what you said there with Spanish flu, even that they loosened up the lockdown and had terrible results, but
yeah,
they didn't keep it going for 2 or 3 years, did they?
Oh God, no.
There's no example of this in human history that anyone.
I believe restrictions were loosened in around September 2018, and then 1918. Yeah, of course, and then it was until do you remember the month in 1920?
1920. Yeah.
When it could be declared as being over.
I think it was late 1920, August or October or something like that.
So, you know, restrictions being lifted in, say, about the September, there were 2 full years of carnage, you know?
Yeah. So we're not, well, I say we, Ireland does not seem likely to do that. And however, this leads to politically, we'll be talking about in other sections and other contributors will be talking about that. So from purely medical perspective, it seems that for as long as this lasts, until we get hold of it through, we mentioned vaccines, or probably just in general having a degree of horrible phrase that Boris Johnson used, herd immunity, will come into it at some point, and it should also be said, this isn't going away, that it's probably here for good now, in the same sense that the other influenzas are here for have been here for good for 100 years and plus, so it's going to be here going.
It's not an influenza, but it could be seasonal like an influenza. Yeah. So every year when you have your flu vaccines, it's just based on scientists making very educated guesses on which strains of flus are going to be most in circulation that year and at risk of being passed on. And those are the strains that they vaccinate against. Now, I think they have a fairly good accuracy rate, but there are some years when the flu vaccine is thought of just as not taking because they picked the wrong strains.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then when we think of vaccinating at-risk groups every year for this NCOV-19, we can see that, you know, there's not going to be enough to go around for everyone. So we could have people dying annually from this.
So one last thing to talk about before we move on to some other contributors. The beginning of this issue in probably December or earlier started with transmission of corona, as you were mentioning, from bats to pangolins to humans, right?
That's the theory.
Now, that is remarkably similar to the plot of a movie that came out in 2011 called
Contagion.
Yeah. Now, in that, they make a very clear statement that the bats' homes were destroyed. They used to live in, I think it started in Thailand in that movie anyway. But the point is,
the bats were angry.
They weren't angry. No. They had to. No, they weren't angry. They lost their homes in through deforestation. They then ended up finding a new home in a abattoir of some sort, or a pig farm. And they spread, the disease spread through a pig, and then the pig was bought by an abattoir, and eventually, long story short, it got into the general population.
Yeah.
Is there any reason to believe that something much, much worse than COVID-19 could come about in the future, once this is all over, through a similar type of thing? Again, whatever it might be, people have talked about permafrost, there's diseases there, all sorts of different things. Is there a chance that something much, much worse than this comes along? And if it does come along, do you think, have learned anything from this?
Well, there is always a chance that we could be looking at something else like this down the line. MERS was, now, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I am pretty sure MERS was bat camel people, you know? So with China's wet markets and just with animal agriculture in general, we're going to be looking at this. You know, if I'm not vegan, I do accept that we probably should be vegan, however. Yeah, you wouldn't be looking at this if everybody was just minding their own business and eating their chickpeas. That's all I'm going to say. But I think we will have learned next time around, in the way that South Korea has acknowledged that testing is the thing to do. Whereas here in Ireland, we're not going to test people who it's highly likely have it, and we tell them to just sit at home for a few weeks. And you're putting that level of trust in people, which is unwise, because, you know, you have people saying, I feel grand now, I'm just going to head to the shops and infecting everybody there. But yeah, hopefully next time we'll be better prepared.
Cool. On that note, we're going to move on to our next contributors. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you. Bye.
Our first contributor is Will, who's based in the UK. He has a background in economics.
Why is capitalism a great economic system, but one that needs to be bailed out by socialism every 10 or so years? So, firstly, two lines went down. The first is GDP, or gross domestic product. This is, broadly speaking, a measure of a country's economic output in terms of value of goods and services. The more you have made, the wealthier your country is, or so the argument goes. Not even the dude who created the GDP measure thinks this, but we'll save this debate on, you know, how best to measure a country's well-being for another time. Anyway, the GDP line is a post-hoc line, so any reckonings as to what this line will do is speculative-ish, but most projections are following the Goldman Sachs analysis and saying they expect GDP to slump by 34% in the USA, and actually perhaps more in China and the UK. The second line that went down was the value of shares in the stock markets. This line went straight into a nosedive, with many countries taking the decision to suspend trading at various points. Now, what does line go down actually mean? Does it mean countries are actually poorer? Well, it depends on how you measure it. If you mean something like, have corporations and individuals who have hoarded mass amounts of wealth in the form of stocks and bonds had millions wiped off their ledgers, then yes. Are these people still wealthier than you and me? Absolutely. If you mean something like our country's now no longer fluid enough to generate funds to pay for infrastructure, then absolutely not. We have learned one thing for sure and one thing less sure, I suppose, during the Rona. First, the less sure thing. Those of us who think labour theory is the accurate description of how value is created have pretty much, but perhaps not, epistemic humility is still important and there are many unknown variables at the moment, but basically we've been vindicated. Marginalism, the current orthodox economic view in capitalism, would struggle to explain the absolute plummeting of the economy when it appears to have coincided so strongly with the plummeting of labour power. Lots of economists who hold this view are now finding many of their colleagues are suddenly agreeing with them. Marxist and neo-Marxist economics is back, baby, although it never really left. Puts on shades, lights a cigarette. Second, but sure, thing. Governments imposing austerity on their country for reasons of economic stability was absolute shite. Austerity is a political choice and always has been a political choice, not an economic necessity. The choice in 2008 to privatise various public services was based on an ideological commitment to shrinking the amount of state assets. And we know this because when those same companies subsequently went bust, the same shower of bastards who told nurses that they couldn't get a pay rise because there was no magic money tree just generated a load of capital to keep them liquid. Nationalise a load of services, fund workers' pay, increase statutory sick pay, and create interest-free loans for businesses on the brink of bankruptcy. Indeed, Donald Trump of Orange Man Bad fame injected over $2 trillion into his economy. I say his economy, I mean the American economy, of course. Loads of people on the left feel vindicated in their insistence that austerity was a fuck. They're also excited as they feel that governments have revealed their economic poker hand by showing what can be done if the will is there. Some on the left are more pessimistic, arguing that we were all excited for the collapse of capitalism in 2008, and look what happened there. Well, is this different from 2008? We need to wait and see where the money goes, to be honest. If the money is used to shore up banks, who then fail to redistribute the money, then yes, it will be the same as 2008. State money going to the private sector is barefaced socialism for the wealthy and nothing else. It takes money out of circulation and into the hands of a wealthy few. If the money is used to renationalise various industries or support services that aim towards the public good, then no, this will be very different to 2008. Taxation takes money out of circulation. Actually, technically, tax destroys money. It takes money out of circulation and essentially redistributes itself back to us. Tax doesn't pay for goods and services, it recuperates the money that went into the economy to pay for these goods and services so that there's not too much inflation-causing surplus money sloshing around. So, what information have we to go on that'll suggest to us how this will play out? In the USA and in Canada, there are talks of rent freezes and the UBI, which, you know, might not be a massive thing, but as a language act, it is incredibly significant. The UK have nominally, sort of, but not quite really, nationalised their railways, flooded the NHS with money, far too late obviously, guaranteed the income of many workers, effectively ended homelessness in London and dramatically reduced it across the country, and released hundreds of billions of pounds out of thin air. Money printer go brr very loudly. But why was it silent before? We need to stop thinking of government spending as determined and start realising that all of this, all of it, is a political choice. Changing the manager of the economy, the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, the Orange Man won't matter. This isn't a management issue. This is a structural issue. If our economy operates in accordance with set success conditions, and these success conditions are absolutely catastrophic for personal and environmental well-being, who is best at managing the line is not really the question we should be asking. We should be asking if the line itself needs to go.
Our second contributor is Vox Delta, who'll be talking about the effects of Corona in Greece and elsewhere in Europe.
Hi everyone, this is Vox Delta, back again for a few words on the current coronavirus situation. As the virus doesn't see borders, we should do the same and see what's going on at the other end of Europe, and more specifically in Greece, there seems to be a period of approximately 1 week time difference between the two countries, with Ireland following Greece in cases, deaths and measures. Very, very quickly, the first cases in Greece were confirmed on the 26th of February, and after a month there have been confirmed slightly more than 1,100 cases and 38 deaths, even though Greece is not testing everyone that has symptoms, so the number of cases is believed to be much higher. It seems that it all started from groups of tourists that visited Italy, Egypt and the city of Jerusalem, but despite we were aware of what was happening in China at the time, no measures were taken and the people were let to go home when they returned to Greece. By the 10th of March, all confirmed cases were either some of the previously mentioned tourists or their contacts. The first measures taken after the 26th of February was the cancellation of all carnival parades that were arranged to happen a few days later, and all sports, competitions, music gigs, etc. Then it all happened very, very quickly. On the 10th of March, it was decided all schools and universities to shut down. On the 13th, it was the turn of cafes, bars and restaurants. On the 16th, all shopping centers shut down. And finally, on the 22nd of March, the full lockdown was announced. At the moment, only supermarkets, bakeries, pharmacies and a few other businesses are still operating. It looks like the Greek government reacted quickly, and the foreign media have hailed them for that, but let's have a closer look at the situation. Greece reacted very quickly indeed, way better than many European countries. And it's probably one of the few times in my life that I saw the vast majority of Greek people being very disciplined and respecting the measures from day one. However, Greece has been really polarized for years, and the current right, far-right government doesn't make it any easier. So, on one side, there are people that support the government and the job they are doing, and on the other side, there are people that oppose the government and criticize their approach on this virus situation. What's the criticism on all this? Before we start, let's say that the Greek health system is way different to the Irish HSE. The big difference is that there are many public hospitals which are accessible to everyone. When I say everyone, I mean everyone. Whoever enters the building is going to be treated by a doctor. It might take time, especially in big cities and the urgency of the case, but everyone is examined and given an advice. Also, prescription from a doctor is not always necessary in order to buy your medicines, which makes life easier and more affordable. There are no fees to visit a hospital. Forget about 100 euro fees to the hospital or 60 euro to your GP to get a letter that will give you access after 2 weeks. You just enter the building. It is a health system very much in favor of the patients and doctors are respected. However, in a free market world, this is not sustainable. That's why all Greek governments constantly cut the budget for the health system since Greece entered the IMF in 2010. So let's go back to the criticism. From day one, people respected the measures, but the argument was, why were the hospitals lacking necessary equipment? Why were they understaffed, and why didn't the government ask the private hospitals to open their doors? The criticism became more intense the following days, when the mass media started playing their role as the government's pet. Or is it the other way around? Just the day before the first confirmed case, the main topic was the refugees in the northeastern Greek-Turkish borders, and the general public was assured that the country was really armored against the virus. Apparently it wasn't. People hear about the measures from the media first, before they are announced by the government. Also, the narrative has been exactly the same as the government's one. It's a perfect alignment. Personal responsibility. If you don't stay home, you'll be responsible for someone else's death. And also, anyone who is not fully committed to the fight against the virus gets bullied. So, if someone criticizes the whole situation, they can be regarded as Turkish and Erdogan's agents. It is clear, and is where the arguments come from, that the government haven't accepted any responsibility themselves yet and try to pass it on to the individuals. No reference to doctors and nurses' requests for help, no reference to the understaffed hospitals, no reference to why the medicine students have not been called to help, despite there are calls for random volunteers, nothing, absolutely nothing. And how could this happen from the time that more than a year ago, the Novartis scandal showed clearly how politicians can make favors to a big multinational pharmaceutical company, favors that are against the public health system, and the big broadcasters and newspapers can easily hide the truth by hosting some advertisement of that multinational company. Does it ring a bell about Apple and other IT companies here in Ireland? What have also the media done so far? Reports that people don't stay in and they are a danger to others because they go to the beach even though the pictures showed empty beaches. And I can assure you, Greeks don't go to the beach in March. It's very cold. Pictures from the toll stations that showed long car queues and the media reporting that those people were irresponsible and apparently the measures were inevitable. Great profits, huh? The fake news revealed and the queues were a result of the lack of personnel in the stations because of the virus and also an issue with the contactless card system. What is the government's response on that? Nothing. Prime Minister's wife first just made a call to the people to applaud the doctors one night at 9 p.m. and of course the doctors politely said just don't clap your hand and help us. Stay home and send us the necessary equipment to protect ourselves and help others. But apart from the health system, which is being tested massively at the moment, the government has also drawn criticism for a number of measures on workers' rights. As in Ireland, many workers are forced to temporary leave because of the measures, about 1 million of them. When Greece asked the IMF help in 2010, one of the very first measures was to give the companies the right to set employees in temporary leave status for as long as they are experiencing financial difficulties by paying them 50% of their salary. This time, the government has gone many steps further. It has given the right to companies to set employees to a temporary leave status by paying nothing, and the state will pay them maximum, 800 euro for the period between mid-March and end of April. A great favor to multinationals, to be honest. The companies are not allowed to fire anyone for this period, but the employees are not protected afterwards. No reference, though, to protection from rents and utility bills for those that have lost their jobs. Teleworking is, of course, the new must for companies who have grabbed the opportunity to set new standards. Prolonged working times, especially for e-shops without a subsequent wage increase, a Facebook contractor company has sent video cameras to employees' homes for monitoring them. Companies that had a physical store and an e-shop are now happy to see their physical store closed as the state takes over the employees' wages while they can focus on the online shop where the sales have gone through the roof. Amazing time to be a big company boss in Greece. Needless to say, the warnings from factory workers for measures that are not taken or respected by the companies as the volumes are high and the demand must be satisfied. So, where are we at? What can anarchists or even the radical left do in this situation where putting your life in danger to satisfy your boss is being perceived as the greatest duty to the nation and the country, while taking political action makes you a criminal? In Greece, grassroots movements have sparked in many cities, similar to the UK. People trying to help the vulnerable ones, those that cannot go out and satisfy their needs, those that cannot take care of themselves, the forgotten ones. Some groups have gone even further and have set up teams that give legal advice to renters and workers, psychological help to those that need it, translators that help refugees or people from other countries that cannot follow the news. At the moment, police is patrolling the whole country. In order to go out, you need to either sign a form at home or send an SMS to a fixed number to get permission to go out. That's all been happening to a country that, according to the government, the vast majority of people has respected the measures. As said, Ireland is following Greece in this situation, so we must be prepared. Let's have in mind two things, the present and the future. First of all, there is no time to waste. We should act now and we are late. And second, we have to act stronger when the measures are lifted. The states and the companies are working for the next day, so we should be ready for that. We follow the measures not because we are told to do so, but because, as anarchists, we know better than anyone that we are responsible for our deeds and actions, and that personal responsibility is the foundation of a free and equal society. We should keep trying helping those that need our help, even now, in a lockdown situation. I know that Varadkar doesn't like the word, but call it whatever you like, it is a lockdown. Those in direct provision centres, those in jails, the elders, they all should be helped. we should intensify our criticism to the government first and all the other political parties that play sick and hide at this situation. The health system is archaic. The number of ICU beds is not enough. The tenants have to be protected, not only freeze the rents, but also push for reducing them, as those who have lost their jobs cannot afford it anyway. Utility bills have to be sorted as well. And finally, start rebuilding our community networks now. Take our neighborhoods and streets back. In a crisis like this, it's our relatives, our friends, and the person next door we can ask help for. Let's not allow the social cannibalism to prevail. Let's not allow them to set their own normality standards, but let's fight for our normality. Organize. And of course, solidarity. Till next time, take care.
Our last contributor is Usheen, who is based in Dublin and works in, well, works in the political side of things.
Good afternoon. I'm recording this in the safest COVID-free zone I know of, which is located opposite the Fianna Fáil Fine Gael mandate to govern and Epstein's Island. So, yeah, I have a few thoughts on Ireland's response to the COVID pandemic. And, yeah, so I'll just get into it right away. So it's less than a week since Papa Varadkar told us to stay home. And we're all crawling the walls a bit, but we're surviving. Having said that, Ireland has announced some positive steps recently, such as the effective universal basic income to deal with the swathes of unemployed people now shut indoors. Also, the private hospitals are effectively in state hands. However, insurance companies, the very same companies who effectively operate a state-mandated cartel, whose profits last year topped 9%, have been asked, in the most toothless appeal yet by Pascal O'Donoghue, to honour the premiums of COVID patients and not to use loopholes like the lizards they are. There really should be legislation to limit premium rises, as the central bank has found no correlation between claims rises and premium increases. But no, because the no-mandate government is afraid of the insurers. We've also nationalised the hospitals on a temporary basis, which should be lauded, until you realise that the costs have mysteriously not been published. It's Fine Gael trickery at its finest. So for now, I guess I'm just going to have to sit in my house and crawl the walls a bit more.
So that's us for our latest issue of the Enemy podcast. We'll be back next time we're back, whenever that is. Hopefully you enjoyed it. To leave us off, I've found a rather bizarre recording of Bernie Sanders and some artists from Vermont, which is a state in the United States, singing This Land Is Our Land. And since he fell out of the American presidential race recently, and he deserves his own issue of the podcast, I'll leave you off with that. Bye-bye.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you. This land is your land, this land is my land. from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You and me.
I've roamed and rambled, I've followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me a voice was sounding. This land was made for you and me.
You and me.
This land is your land.
Thank you.